Welcome to Brexit Watch from World Update on the BBC World Service. I'm Dan Damon. This week, the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has been declaiming his hopes for post-Brexit Europe. We'll analyse what he means. And following on from our programme from Northern Ireland on the extremely tricky border question, that's still available, that programme, for download, by the way, the Irish Times writer Fintan O'Toole will tell us why he thinks it's a conundrum that can never be satisfactorily solved. This is Brexit Watch. Jean-Claude Juncker, the President of the European Commission, made a speech this week, in three languages, by the way, laying out his vision for the future of Europe. He echoes the renewed, confident tone of European leaders, who seem to be recovering from the insecurity about the project's future that followed the Brexit referendum last year. To get some thoughts on the Commission President's speech, I spoke to Dr. Ben Margulies. He's an American political scientist now teaching at the University of Warwick in the English Midlands. Does he think that Mr. Juncker's confident tone is based on fantasy or reality?
I wouldn't call it a fantasist vision. I mean, a lot of what he's talking about in terms of creating a European finance minister, in terms of deeper fiscal and monetary integration, are things that the European Union has been talking about for some years. Emmanuel Macron also talked about a variant of this idea of a Eurozone finance minister. So, I mean, he didn't come up with anything that was radically different from what other European Union leaders or European member state leaders had been saying for some time, you know, saying that Europe will take the lead in climate change, or saying that Europe will develop stronger competences in defense, or what have you. These are all things that have been bouncing around the European Union's elite policy circles for a while. So I'm not going to say necessarily that they will come to pass, but they weren't wildly outside the accepted circle of thinking.
Let's talk about those financial proposals, mm-hmm. the European Finance Minister and a European Monetary Fund, mm-hmm. in effect, to try to avoid future Eurozone shocks. Mm-hmm. How would a European Finance Minister actually operate? What would her or his job be?
The gist of the idea is a Eurozone finance minister would be able to shift fiscal resources around in the event of recession to prevent, you know, sudden imbalances. One of the problems that the European Union has is that when there's an economic slowdown in one part of the union, there's not really a way for the center to compensate for that the way that, for example, in Britain, when the north became less competitive, the Blair government was able to expand public employment there and keep the show running for several years. There isn't the same sort of mechanism in the European Union. So when Greece suffered a debt crisis and a recession, there's no way for them to increase demand by sending money south. So the idea is that if they had a finance minister and a common budget, they might be able to compensate for some of these regional imbalances somewhat better and prevent this sort of really severe recessions and debt crises that have resulted earlier in this decade.
Let's turn now to some of the other problems facing the European Union, and mm-hmm. migration poses one of those, and Hungary and Poland and Slovakia have all of them refused to fit in with the quota system, the allocation mm-hmm. of those who have come here as asylum seekers or mm-hmm. as refugees. And Jean-Claude Juncker spoke about that and how important it was to listen to the rules set by the European Court of Justice. Let's hear what he said.
Our member states have given the European Court of Justice the powers to take the ultimate decision, and that means ECJ judgments have to be respected in all cases. Failing to respect them or undermining the independence of national justice systems means selling citizens' fundamental rights. In the European Union, the rule of law is not optional. It's a duty. Our union is not a state, but it is still governed by the rule of law.
Dr. Margulies, that's all very well, but how can the centre force countries like Hungary and Poland to take people inside their borders when they don't want to?
That's an excellent question. The simple problem is that sanctioning Hungary or Poland is quite difficult because it requires, at some stage of the process, the unanimous agreement of the members of the European Council. So Hungary can protect Poland with its veto and vice versa. And of course, the European Union doesn't have its own independent military forces. So the European Court of Justice is traditionally relied on the willing cooperation of member states and the strength of that sort of legalistic culture. It's not clear how they would enforce these refugee quotas aside from moral suasion or a very complicated sanctions regime. It's not like a proper federation where, were this to happen in the United States, the U.S. government could deploy its own police or even the military to force compliance. So, it's not clear. It's a weakness. When Juncker said the EU is not a state, I mean, that's the key weakness on his side. It doesn't have the agencies and the powers necessary to physically compel obedience.
And it was those countries, Poland and Hungary, that when the British voted to leave the European Union, said, yes, this is it. It's a collection of nation states. It's not going to be a super state. Mm-hmm. Has that, despite their refusal to take the quotas on migrants, has that robust resistance to the ever-widening, ever more powerful union, is that weakening a year after the Brexit vote?
Is Polish and Hungarian resistance weakening? The main limit to their resistance isn't fear of the European Union somehow occupying or compelling them into line. It's that their own populaces, their own voters are actually highly pro-EU. There's a limit to, you know, how far they're going to want to take a confrontation with the European Union. It's the same thing with Greece, where clearly they didn't want austerity, but ultimately they accepted it because they were more terrified of leaving the Eurozone. So, I mean, the main restraint, I think, in European resistance isn't the passage of time or Brussels. It's more simple Polish and Hungarian popular support for the EU. Is their resistance, is the resistance of their governments weakening? And I'm sorry this is going on so long. I think they've always been conscious of how far they can go with the European Union, at least so far. And they're in this dynamic as populists where they have to keep challenging an elite, especially this transnational elite in alliance with these awful refugees. So I don't think it's weakening simply because those governments need that antagonism to survive. I think the question is, will they continue to keep it within certain bounds that avoid a really severe clash with the EU that might alienate their own voters?
Here's what Jean-Claude Juncker said about Brexit, that it'll be a sad day.
Le 29 mars 2019, le Royaume-Uni quittera l'Union européenne.
The 29th of March 2019, the United Kingdom will leave the European Union. That will be at the same time a sad and tragic moment.
Nous le regretterons toujours.
We will always regret this, and you will come to regret it too.
Mais nous devons respecter la volonté du peuple britannique.
Nevertheless, we have to respect the will of the British people. But we are going to move forward. We are going to move forward because Brexit is not everything, because Brexit is not the future of Europe.
Do you think, Dr. Margulies, that the other 27 are united on the question of Brexit? They may be not united on the question of migration, on the power of the Eurozone and who's to fund it when it gets into trouble and all of that. But do you think that on this issue of Brexit, it's pretty much a united stance?
It's hard to say there's a united stance on Brexit when it's not entirely clear what it is the British want as part of the transitional deal. I think that there probably is a united stance on a unity behind Merkel's statement that the single market freedoms of capital, of goods, of services, and of course of labor, that is the freedom of migration. I think on that point, there probably is a high degree of unity among EU members simply because for Western European states, there is a strong legal commitment to the single market. And for Eastern European states, it's their main benefit. So on that point, I think you have a strong degree of unity, yes. Regarding the other precise policy questions, I mean, I don't know if they've gotten into that yet. I don't think there's, beyond that, I think it's hard to tell if there's unity because we're still somewhat unsure what shape Brexit will take.
Dr. Ben Margulies. Last Friday, we took World Update to Derry, Londonderry in Northern Ireland, very close to the border with the Republic of Ireland. If Brexit negotiations go badly, the current invisible border might have to be re-erected, with all of the dangers that that would pose for the peace deal that brought IRA and Ulster Loyalist paramilitary violence to an end in 1998. The British government says it'll find a way to keep the border invisible while still imposing customs and migration regulations. How they'll do that has not been fully explained. I spoke to the Irish Times writer, Fintan O'Toole.
The more you look at it, the more it becomes clear that there's actually no rational solution at all if Britain pulls out of the customs union. So if Britain were to stay within the customs union, at least then you can see a way of minimising the damage and of having some kind of rational arrangements whereby people can actually share the islands, which is what the overwhelming majority of Irish people want to do. But if Britain is out of the customs union, which is the current intention, it's very difficult to see how the claim that's being made in the British position paper that there will be no border, there will be no visible signs of a border at all, how that can be made any kind of reality. It just seems like pure fantasy.
It seems to me there are two main issues. One is that technical solution, if there is one, the so-called frictionless border, which nobody's ever been able to explain to me properly. But there is the identity issue, the constitutional issue of what happens to this part of the island. How has that changed and what might happen?
I think the technical questions are less important than the identity questions, you know. And I don't think people in Britain ever fully grasped what the Belfast Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, the peace deal was about. It was about saying that there's a new kind of identity here, you know, which is multiple, which is fluid, which allows people a choice where you don't have to be forced necessarily into old tribal corners. And this was a very radical and progressive and in many ways wonderful breakthrough. It's what's allowed us to have the kind of peace that we do have. And what Brexit does is it says, no, actually, we're drawing lines again. You know, we're saying that you must be conscious of exactly what part of the island you're on. But also, people keep talking about it won't be like the borders of the past, and that's absolutely right. It's much worse. So it's never been this huge international frontier. I mean, a frontier between 27 nations and Britain. And so, yes, of course, all the trade issues and the issues of passport controls, all those kind of things are very important. But the bigger thing is just saying you have to sort of freeze your identity somehow, and you have to be on one side of this line or another. And that really goes very fundamentally against the whole nature of the Belfast Agreement. It goes against, for example, the fact that everybody in Northern Ireland has an absolute right under international law to be an Irish citizen as well as a British citizen. They can have both identities. And that now means, of course, they can be both inside and outside the European Union. So, you know, how can that be honoured? How can you say that these people have an absolute right to be citizens of the European Union, and at the same time they're being taken out of the European Union? And this is where really profound radical thought is necessary to actually say we have to start with what we've guaranteed people under the Belfast Agreement and then try to see how that can be preserved insofar as it's possible.
Well, we're here at the launch of Malachy O'Doherty's book on Gerry Adams. What are the opportunities here for Sinn Féin? Are they playing this part of the game right?
I think up to a point Sinn Féin have been playing the game right in that they've obviously made the border a very big issue. And you know, I think there's a huge sympathy very broadly, and not just in nationalist Ireland. I mean, I would think most people look at it and say, you know, this is really a horrific mess. And Sinn Féin have been obviously very coherent and very clear in saying that this is just not feasible. You can't really do it, and it's dangerous, and you shouldn't be going down this road. The problem then is that Sinn Féin can't stop itself from trying to suggest another simplistic solution, right, which is the United Ireland, right, and asking for a border poll. And that sort of obsession with a border poll, with the idea of a unitary solution, kind of misses the point in a way, that the damage that's being done is to the idea of multiplicity, of fluidity. And there's not going to be a United Ireland anytime soon. I mean, it may well be an entirely legitimate way of looking at things over the long term, but it's not going to happen now. What's going to have to happen is something much, much more subtle, much more complex and much more ambiguous than that.
Fintan O'Toole from the Irish Times. And if you have a different view, get in touch using Twitter at BBC Dan Damon or on Facebook on the Dan Damon Journalist page. That's Brexit Watch. More next week. Tell your friends.